Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Joined today by Josh Blank, research director of the Texas Politics Project, here and enjoying the weather, I think.
Love it. Yeah, it's great out.
Very nice. So
our 2 weeks.
So we'll get to it. We talked last week about the general contours of Texas public opinion on emerging and established, for that matter, legislative priorities. You know, largely in the seam between anticipation of Governor Abbott's State of the State address on one hand, which he delivered a few days ago.
Yep.
And prior to that, the unveiling of Lieutenant Governor Patrick's priorities. The thing people were waiting for, you know, most hotly was the degree to see what Governor Abbott chose to classify as emergency items to affect the legislative agenda. The governor promulgated 7 items, and we're going to go through fairly quickly and just kind of touch on some of the public opinion correlates, maybe comment on the non-public opinion correlates of some of this stuff. But, you know, we'll be dealing with this a lot. So this is really just kind of laying down, again, some baselines and a little bit of context in the aftermath of the State of the State speech. So the 7 emergency items were property tax reduction, investment in water, increasing teacher pay, expanding career training. It's a little vague, but I think, you know, primarily in K-12, you know, or some faction, probably the back
pathways.
Half of K-12.
Yeah.
High school would be my guess, but school choice, of course, interestingly, didn't lead with that in the speech. Didn't need to, I guess. It was so anticipated. Bail reform of the more punitive variety and the establishment, and this was, I think, the not on people's bingo cards unless you were very inside, the establishment of a Texas cyber command in San Antonio.
Exciting.
So let's, you know, we'll start at the top and I've made the comment about school vouchers, but ultimately the placement of vouchers, and we come down to that, maybe we can talk about this more, probably does reflect some things that are in public opinion that we know about, but also reflects what we know about in public opinion, that property tax relief was the number what was given pride of place. The governor put out a pretty big number, expressed no preferences on how to do this, which was the big source of friction and frankly, meltdown in the last legislative session. But he provided a very big number. So let's roll tape. We've got a little excerpt for you from the governor's speech on property tax reduction.
Last session, we slashed your property taxes. But for many Texans, those cuts were wiped out by local taxing authorities that hiked your property taxes even more. That must end this session. I want at least $10 billion more in property tax cuts for our fellow Texans. But here's the deal. That will only work if local authorities cannot use loopholes to jack up your property taxes like Harris County did. They increased your property taxes by more than 10% last year. Loopholes that increase your property taxes must be closed. No taxing entity should be able to raise your property taxes without a 2/3 approval of voters. No approval, no new taxes.
Okay, so that, you know, that's a little bit of a long excerpt, but I thought it covers
a lot of ground.
It ultimately saves us some time because it illustrates, you know, the big number, $10 billion, pretty good opening bid.
Right. We know who the enemy is.
And pivots to a familiar foil for these kinds of things, both rhetorically and policy-wise, and that is local government. And I think we also know from the polling data that, you know, this is an issue that the state leadership, particularly the governor and the lieutenant governor, are focused on. They've acted on it pretty consistently for the last few sessions now.
Right.
We discussed this a few weeks ago. You know, the lieutenant governor has basically said that if we use the mechanism which he prefers, then you just have to keep going back to the well every session. And it's just something they got to do every session is, you know, they got to keep a tab on property taxes and do what they can to reduce them to keep up for the countervailing pressures. I don't think the lieutenant governor's going to have any problem getting after the locals. He hasn't in the past. But it was an interesting choice, you know, as you were saying right away after the speech, for the governor to, you know, kind of pivot away from the fight over that delivery mechanism and the messy, boring details and towards a familiar target and another, you know, a means of doing this, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the point is that one, you know, he's out there probably with the biggest, you know, property tax cut proposal of anybody because it's not, you know, I wouldn't say it's not realistic, but it's not tethered to reality in any sense because they don't have to figure out.
It's a big lift.
It's a big lift. But I think, look, what this reflects is something we've talked about for a long time, which is the reality of the fact that from a public opinion perspective, property taxes are tough.
Yeah.
And they're tough because, you know, ultimately property values are not under the control of the Texas government. They're not under control of the local governments. They're not in control of anybody. And so if property values go up, generally property taxes go up. Now, I will say the governor is being more than a little bit misleading because the legislature has passed laws recently that limit the extent to which local governments can raise property tax revenue, not property tax, even just their total revenue.
Right.
It can't be more than 3.5% without a voter-approved election, which is why he wants to raise that threshold to 2/3. So even sort of the context of this is a little bit more complicated because what he's talking about is actually already in place. Voters already have to approve large, you know, quote-unquote large increases. Places like Austin are actually heading towards a bit of a fiscal cliff right now in terms of, you know, providing basic services. And in most cases, voters have approved these, like, you know, these sorts of efforts, whether they be through tax rate elections. I don't think there actually been many, but bond elections have generally passed until this last cycle, which I think he may be picking up on that. Now, in the polling data, it's really kind of very telling. I'll get through this really quick, which is if you look to the last legislative session, we look at August 2023, once they finally got to the end of that whole property tax fight, they had passed something. We'd seen a lot of dissatisfaction with the legislature in June when they were still fighting over property taxes, including among Republicans. But once they passed the bill, when we said, hey, do you expect property taxes that Texans pay to increase, decrease, stay the same? 38% of Texas voters said they expected to increase. Only 32% expected a decrease, even after the special sessions, all the noise about property tax reduction. Asked at the end of the year, in December of 2023, how confident they were that the legislature had done enough to reduce property taxes to make a difference to Texans, 29% of Texans said they were extremely or very confident. 38% said they were not very or not confident. Only 35% of Republicans were extremely or very confident. Only 15% extremely. Only 32% of conservatives. So ultimately, this is sort of one of these things we keep going back to, which is, you know, first of all, there's a history of promising property tax cuts. The history then is met with the reality of, you know, historically in Texas over the last couple of decades, increasing property values that wipe out often those cuts. But ultimately, the legislature has been trying to address this with this sort of push and pull. And again, we won't get into the constellation this has with school finance and all that stuff. We'll leave that aside. But ultimately, it's really challenging.
Yeah. I mean, you need to have a pretty big number.
Yeah.
To implement a degree of relief that people will notice,
right?
Given this, you know, the context that you were talking about, particularly rising real estate.
And I think it's important to point out here that, you know, the lack of confidence that people share about the legislature's ability to affect this has been bipartisan. It's among conservatives.
Sure.
So this is something where this is not, you know, Democratic sour grapes. This is also, you know, responding to the majority of the electorate.
Well, I think that's the other shoe dropping of, you know, picking an issue that you know plays well broadly, but especially with your constituents, but a hard issue that is difficult to solve. So let's move on to water.
Okay.
So, you know, second thing was water. Again, Governor Abbott less specific, again, in calling for investment in water infrastructure, but did hit it pretty hard. And again, also signaled, you know, a willingness to spend. And we're not going to do excerpts for everything, but we have an excerpt on water infrastructure too. So let's roll that tape.
Last session, we invested $1 billion in water projects and infrastructure. This session, we need to Texas size that investment. Working with Senator Perry and Representative Cody Harris, we're going to put Texas on a path to have plenty of water for the next 5 decades. We will make the largest investment in water in the history of the state of Texas. We will tap into new water supplies. We will repair pipes to save billions of gallons of water every year. This generational investment in water is so important, I am declaring it an emergency item this session.
Okay, so interesting. Why don't we just jump? So, you know, water is an interesting issue. You know, moves the needle somewhat with on public opinion in terms of salience, willingness to spend.
Yeah.
But, you know, a perennial, you know, infrastructure issue.
Yeah, I mean,
right, in which, you know, doesn't make the blood pulse, the blood, you know, boil on anybody's part other than maybe Senator Perry. Mm-hmm. But if you ask people about it, they, you know, they see it, but they don't. It doesn't come up in the open-endeds a lot, for example.
Right, because the thing about water is it's fine until it's not working.
Yeah.
And so, and the issue in Texas is that it's not been working for a lot of people too often over the last few years. We've seen in polling almost a third of Texans saying that they've experienced a boil water notice in the last year. We see very little confidence that the legislature has done much at the end of the last session to improve the reliability of the water supply. And when we asked in December whether the state's spending too much, too little, or the right amount on water, 44% too little, well, that was a little bit lower among Republicans, 38% said too little, 47% of rural Texans said too little. And I think that's where you're starting to see also a little bit of the push, because some of the oldest infrastructure is in parts of the state that honestly, you know, the Republican elected class really tries to cater to here.
Yeah. Well, and remember, you know, the parts, you know, it's the political geography is complicated because a lot of the parts of the state with no water are very Republican parts. Now, for that matter, a lot of the parts in East Texas with a lot of water, also very Republican.
Well, honestly, so I don't want to. Well, and a lot of the parts of the state that have been experiencing those boiled water notices haven't been in Harris County, haven't been in Travis. They've been actually in sort of some of these more exurban places that are growing faster and actually need the infrastructure.
So, you know, I mean, I can't leave that issue, although I want to move it without noting that, you know, where he did get specific on that sounded a little to me like the argument for the big federal infrastructure bill made a few years ago by Joe Biden.
I'm not advised.
just kind of noticing that. And it also does make me wonder how much of that spending is also going to be amplified by, you know, the downstream spending in that infrastructure bill, because the water stuff, the funding for water projects, as I recall in that bill, was spaced out, and whether that money will still be there.
Open question.
You know, given what's going on nationally. Okay. Third gets us into, you know, the education realm, the next couple. So, you know, I think not super surprisingly, given the politics and that he's done, you know, not the first time, teacher pay was also on the list, you know, slam dunk public opinion wise, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like,
for the most part.
Yeah. I mean, you know, regardless of what, you know, what the messaging is around this in terms of the amount of money that Texas puts into public education, and we're not going to contextualize that right now. I'm sure we'll have time to talk about that in a later podcast. When we ask, you know, Texas voters whether or not the state is spending too much or too little on public education, the plurality, almost a majority, 49% in December of last year said too little. This also included a plurality of Republican voters, 37%, who said that we were spending too little. You know, when we ask about the importance of different public education priorities, teacher pay or teacher retention is usually very high. 78% of voters in August of 2024 said it was extremely or very important for the legislature to address teacher pay or teacher retention. That included 90% of Democrats, but also 66% of Republicans. And when we actually ask, like, what should be the top sort of public education priority, and the last time we did this was in August of last year, you know, teacher pay and retention only came in after school safety and curriculum content.
Right.
And so it's just, it is a perennial issue. And I think, you know, people don't, you know, I think what people outside the education space don't understand is something that parents do is that the beginning of the school year starts and all of a sudden it's like, do we have enough teachers in these classes? And you start looking around the state to see where they're looking for teachers, where they have shortages, where they're combining classes, moving people around. And parents notice that and parents tend to vote. So.
And in the, you know, in the sheer politics of this, of course, you know, pairing increasing pay for teachers with school choice is kind of a key component of, smoothing the rough edges of the appearance of the voucher school choice ESA program. This was came up very explicitly yesterday in the debate on the Senate floor. We sort of skipped over this in the beginning. I was going to mention something about it. And of course, you know, we should mention in relationship to this and when we get to school vouchers, you know, the Senate passed the school voucher bill on the floor yesterday. So their version of this is set. And at one point, you know, during the debate, you know, and the debate went on all day, I didn't see it all, but certainly at least one juncture I saw when I was watching, the lieutenant governor stepped in to make sure that when teacher pay came up in part of the exchange on the floor, that he reminded everybody the Senate had passed teacher pay before, that was the House's problem. We value teachers, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think he literally said, don't blame us.
Right. So it's very much, you know, in the mix on that. Now, the next emergency item that the governor declared, you know, a sleeper in the public salience sense.
Yeah,
right?
In a way, yeah.
But interesting, I mean, you know, there are public opinion correlates we can talk about here. And this is career training. And look, the governor's emphasis on career training follows on major legislation passed in 2023 that was aimed at aligning K-12 and community college practices with workforce development. And, you know, decently funded, paired with a bill that, you know, also created targets for community colleges, et cetera. There's a lot of moving parts in here we won't get into policy-wise. But, you know, I mean, I think it's worth noting, you know, this bill got a lot of national attention. I mean, it was one of those, it was a real workhorse, you know, kind of meat and potatoes, but with some interesting undertones in terms of, you know, the state making moves to try to align siloed agencies that, you know, on this line should be cooperating, TEA, the Higher Education Coordinating Board and the Workforce Development Commission. And for those of you already falling asleep, you know, but it's interesting that they're continuing to push this. And I think there are other kind of elements there having to do with attitudes towards higher ed that are at play here. But also, I think in a policy-wise, and I've been kind of harping on this a little bit and harped on it with some of the lawmakers when I had the opportunity and didn't get pushed back as hard as I thought, that, you know, this is part of an emerging approach to, you know, a focused economic development strategy in the state that borders on industrial policy when it comes to some of the targets in healthcare, in technology, and a couple other areas that are embedded in all this legislation. So there are, I guess that's a way of saying, this seems like kind of a sleepy thing. There are a lot of stakeholders and a lot of powerful stakeholders in the state and around the country that are watching this. And it's an area where Texas has actually gotten a bit of, you know, some bipartisan plaudits in terms of being very purposeful and kind of forward-looking in this kind of activity.
Yeah, I like the way you said that because I think that's right. I mean, we know that people are concerned about the cost of higher education. We know that there are a lot of growing negative attitudes towards higher education institutions broadly, public education institutions. We also know that there are a lot of Texans who feel like they need more career training or who don't feel like they're in a career. And I think what we also know about the public school population in the state at this point is that the reality is that it's not all going to college. If we look at kind of the tracks that we've seen, you know, across socioeconomic statuses over time, there need to be more pathways for this state to kind of keep churning. And I think the way you said that is right, is industrial policy. And the thing I'll add that I didn't add before is like the property tax thing also touches on people's concern over housing costs. And so to the extent that people are concerned about housing costs, education, healthcare, this is very much sort of a, like, how is Texas going to address these things? Big, large urban state, big, diverse state, a lot of need, still small government, conservative.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think it, you know, from a more, you know, whatever, 30,000 foot perspective, you could walk away from the governor's speech. And, you know, we've talked about this before, and this is why in some ways it's good to be governor. You know, the governor doesn't have to stand up there and just provide red meat.
Right.
I mean, there's got to be some red meat in the meal. You know, no vegetarians here, but you can, you know, once you have a little red meat in there, you know, the governor has, you know, this, and to be fair to him, for all the, you know, ideological and political things that, that Greg Abbott has done that look purely driven by some of those or largely driven by that, there has been a sustained attention to economic development and a more macro view of what's going on in the state.
Yeah.
And that has affected some of the agenda items in the legislature over the last couple of sessions. So, okay, then, you know, after we look at the career training and the teacher pay, we do get to the red meat and you know, the issue du jour, if you will, in the Republican Party, at least in elite circles, I would argue, is school choice gets declared an emergency item. No big surprises here. You know, widely assumed that after Abbott actively, you know, threw down the gauntlet and punished House, did his best to punish Republican House members who voted against school choice last time in the 2024 primary and, you know, had a pretty good success rate, school choice would be designated an emergency item, delivers as such, and, you know, no disappointment in these expectations. We've talked a lot about this. We kind of know, you know, where things are. On one hand, if you ask about this, particularly in a question that doesn't mention how you're paying for it at all or makes no reference to it, majority support for ESAs, overwhelming support among Republicans. You add the tax component, it goes down, you know, about, what, 8 points.
Overall,
and goes down about, you know, 11 among Republicans. But as, you know, somebody was, you know, has written, you know, writing in the Texan recently, I think it's fair to say that, you know, clearly Republican messaging on this has been successful in conjunction with the pandemic and its aftermath and people's views and experiences of public education, to where, you know, our polling prior to the pandemic showed lower levels of support.
Yeah.
You know, overall, and even among Republicans, and that's moved, and school choice proponents saw their moment and they've seized it.
Yeah.
And public opinion reflects that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the reality of this is that, you know, my sort of quick thumbnail sketch is that, you know, if you ask people, they're generally pro the idea of some kind of choice. When you start to actually talk about specifics, you're going to peel back support and in different ways and among different groups, depending on what you talk about, which is why this is sort of a sticky area. The reason that for that, which we've talked about a lot, is because this is not super salient for most people. Most people will never, you know, put their kid in, you know, a private school.
Right.
A lot of people are just not going to have kids in the public schools or past that part in their life. And this isn't salient. And that's sort of the key point I just want to make here. When we ask voters, you know, how important basically is passing, you know, this some sort of ESA voucher school choice program, you know, in August of 2024, 45% it was extremely or very important. But this is less than, say, the same about—
And this was among education priorities.
This is about among just education priorities. Right, so this is, because just to say, if it were among all priorities, it wouldn't even register. It just wouldn't register. But compared to other priorities, it was less than said the same about facility improvements, what books are in the libraries, parental rights, public school financing, curriculum content, teacher pay and teacher attention, and school safety.
Right.
So now, having said that, I just make a point here. That's kind of actually in some ways doesn't really matter at this point. The fact that it's kind of a low salience thing probably gives a little bit more flexibility and a little more room to roam on this. And I think that was actually what's so great about the Senate debate yesterday was, in some ways, you know, I think, you know, Senator Crane did a really good job of taking some of the Democratic sort of criticisms and saying, you don't really care about this stuff. Now, look, some of them really do care about some of these things in an ideological sense. But where he's right is, I don't think there are a lot of voters on either side who have strong ideological views for or against vouchers in the way that people in the elite space talk about it, church state separation, you know, defunding the public school, et cetera, it's, you know, standards, all the stuff. And he's right about that. And that just shows how much this has moved in a lot of ways.
So, you know, a lot more to come on that, you know, once we see the House bill and once we see, you know, what we get a little more information about what's going on in the House. But okay, bail reform, something else that the governor has introduced before, you know, has been a priority. Evidence continues to mount that the brief interlude of bipartisan criminal justice reform that, to my mind, emerged in the aughts and the early 2010s is pretty much over. You know, recently, as a few years ago, mention of bail reform would have been expected to refer to making cash bail less punitive, investing more for diversion of nonviolent offenders, et cetera. You know, there are still advocates for that. I'm not saying that those arguments aren't going on, but this is not what the governor is talking about. The governor, you know, the setup in the speech, which was, you know, stage managed, I would say, and I'm not saying that the governor's response was insincere, you know, in the moment. But, you know, they had the widow of a Harris County law enforcement officer who'd been murdered by some criminals that had been let out on bail from a prior murder charge, et cetera. So they're looking for stronger limits on parole and bail.
Yeah. I think this is where studying public opinion is really useful, because we know from, you know, prior questions that, you know, a majority of Texas voters said they support preventing people accused of a nonviolent crime from being sort of basically kept in jail because they can't afford bail. So that version of bail reform still exists. It's still out there. But I'll just say right now, we don't have this. We probably will at some point. But if you were to poll and say, hey, should we prohibit judges from letting people accused of violent crimes out on bail? I'm going to tell you, I think I know that a majority of people would say, yeah, we shouldn't do that. Now, that just sets aside all of the complexities that have sort of been—
The ethical and constitutional questions at play.
Yeah, the ethical and constitutional questions at play, you know, the reality of the way those laws have been applied that were discussed kind of in the lead up and during a lot of this bail reform discussion. It sets all that aside. But honestly, for most people who, you know, are not going to be accused of a violent crime in their life, it sort of just makes sense not to let those people out.
Right.
So it's a winner. I mean,
I think so. And, you know, and look, you know, with the lag, you know, the law and order concerns about crime, which, you know, I think the lag is beginning to kick in. I feel like I'm hearing a little bit less drumbeat on general crime than we were a year ago, because the crime rates are in fact going down in most places.
Well, and because the occupant in the White House has shifted, and you know,
well,
it's just,
even yeah.
I mean, I agree with you. This is the reality, but yeah, the politics of this has shifted dramatically.
Yeah,
now. We're no longer living in the hellhole that we
right.
were.
I mean, and look, well, and the thing is, I mean,
it
doesn't matter, but I mean, the Trump point could actually go both ways, because, you know, Donald Trump likes to talk about disorder and criminality and whether the empirical reference are there or not.
Right.
Okay, then, you know, the emergency item least likely to be on your bingo card or drinking game, the establishment of a Texas Cyber Command. Lots of, you know, both practical political economy reasons.
Yeah.
You know, this makes sense. I mean, I still think it's interesting that it was an emergency item rather than just a legislative priority. But it does, in a time of, you know, probably some degree of anxiety about tech companies and also security breaches and concerns about Chinese-Iranian, Russian cybersecurity threats. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to speak to this in the environment. And also just, the political economy of putting one of these establishing this in San Antonio, you know, there's a lot of the factors of production that make this, you know, a reasonable thing to do are there in San Antonio, from the military bases to a cybersecurity kind of private sector, public-private sector overlap. All of that very much in play. And, you know, look, it's also something of an economic development. Hey, we're paying attention to you, to, you know, the northern end of South Texas.
Right.
So, you know, all of that kind of makes sense to me. We don't have a lot of polling on any cybersecurity initiatives that I can recall.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that has sort of been interesting in the last, you know, few weeks or months or whatever is, you know, sort of the extent to which Texas's governments, and I sort of mean county governments, local government, state government, have you know, demonstrated themselves susceptible to hacks. And I think, you know, Texas is one of those things. You know, Texas really plays—
There you go again, picking on local governments, Josh.
Well, I said all of them, you know. but the thing is, you know, Texas really places itself kind of at the forefront of protecting the privacy and the data of its citizens. And to the extent that that data is, you know, being let out, you know, all over the place, I think there's sort of a critical infrastructure aspect to this. And it kind of, you know, speaks to water, it speaks to housing. You know, when the Republicans have been in charge of state government for over two decades, there's nowhere to point the finger. So if China, you know, gets into our electric grid or our water supply, or, you know, another one of the big counties, you know, gives out all of its payment information or something accidentally, it's like, who do you blame? And at a certain point, it's kind of like, you know, you kind of need to step up. But I think to your point also, Texas is one of the few states that's really uniquely, and especially Central Texas actually, is really uniquely set up to establish something like this that could actually have, you know, national, you know, ramifications for other states because of the military bases, because of sort of the tech center that Austin is. We do actually have the talent here.
Yeah.
And that talent, I should say, is like very, very limited.
And when you look into it, there's also, I mean, I think, and, you know, there's a real, you know, the kind of military presence in San Antonio overall.
Yeah.
You can't really underestimate how much that seeps into all, you know, all in all kinds of different directions.
Yeah.
You know, in the sense of, you know, when you sort of read the response to this and was kind of reading around a little bit, You know, there's probably a lot of, you know, retired military people that have now gone and gotten involved in these cybersecurity companies. So this is kind of what, a long time ago, they probably didn't use this to, you know, what used to be called agglomeration, right? Which is the development of economic specialties due to the presence of various factors of production. That's kind of really going on here.
Yeah.
You know, I think in San Antonio. So any, you know, a couple of quick overall, anything you want to kind of flag that, as you walked away from the speech going, oh, well, there's, and it, there may not be. I mean, there were not a lot of big surprises here.
Yeah, I mean, I would say from a public opinion standpoint, and I mean, this is not surprising, but it was interesting. I mean, the extent to which, you know, DEI sort of popped up over and over again throughout the speech and in various different domains. I mean, not surprising given the
without being itself an item.
Right. And I think that was pretty interesting. I mean, I think it's not surprising given the extent to which, you know, obviously the president has been highlighting, you know, sort of anti-DEI positions, you know, throughout the government. But at the same time, and we know from our polling, you know, not too long ago that DEI used to be sort of a fringe concept and people were pretty unfamiliar with it. I doubt that's the case anymore, but it's going to be interesting. I mean, it's interesting to see how much, I guess, you know, what the legs of that kind of movement look like, because it really has become this amorphous thing. And, you know, that's both, you know, useful. It can be useful, but it can also, you know, create exposure. And I'm just curious to see how that plays out.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, you can, what I could, I mean, I think that's all reasonable. I think I, you know, I'm tempted to overinterpret a little bit here.
Oh, really?
You know, in the sense, well, just in the sense of if we are having this conversation about organizing principles and, you know, the kind of the political approach a few years ago, it would have been more about, you know, and we, you know, dancing around the notion of nativism and, you know, this kind of notion of cultural identity, you know, the back cultural identity backlash in the aftermath of the Obama election and the rise of, you know, whatever, wokeness, whatever you want to call it. You know, it's hard for me not to feel like, well, you know, it's not like border politics have gone away.
Right.
But the chaos at the border, the threat of being overrun and all this is a little harder to play right now when the flow of immigrants is and migrants is. You know, last year, you know, as long ago as, you know, early last year, was already slowing to a trickle.
Yeah.
And, but it's the same kind of, the underlying cultural politics are very similar to that, to your point. So I would also add before we go that in terms of state politics, you know, this is a pretty assertive, confident, agenda-setting Greg Abbott. Now, that's his job in this speech.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think on the range of, you know, having been at a few of these and seen a few of them now, all things being equal, a pretty confident, assertive performance.
I thought he had a great, I mean, you know. As someone who watches this professionally, so this is not about like my own preferences or any, I think he did a really good job. I mean, I think, you know, the thing is it'd be very easy to lean into the red meat. It'd be very easy to sort of go on offense in various ways. And I think, you know, he was able to, you know, dangle red meat, but also I think do it in a way that says, look, I'm trying to address things, trying to address housing, trying to address water, you know, worried about, you know, again, the security of the state, right? And then a big education bucket. And so it's like, you can't look at that speech and say, you know, even whether you agree or disagree with his approach to these questions, you can't say, I mean, we can look at our own polling, that he's not speaking to the concerns that Texans have imagined. That was sort of my overarching thing watching the speech. I think I said this to my wife while watching. I said, like, he's dancing all over our polling. Now, our polling ideally is influenced by what people tell us is important. Yeah. And so his is as well. And you could see that there. And so it's going to be interesting to see how much the legislature follows through with this. And, you know, I mean, the end game is really where we're, you know, where I'm looking. I mean, it's a ways from here, but Abbott's laid some, you know, markers down in the sand. And the question is, you know, can the legislature get close enough to them for him to be okay with it or not?
And well, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to trigger too much grousing or, you know, not be too willfully ignorant or, you know, ignore context. I mean, this is the moment when, you know, I mean, when we teach intro classes or we talk to people, you know, trying to talk to people to orient them towards the rhythm of the session. I mean, this is a moment where the governor has a lot of public influence over the process and a lot of attention on him. That will now ebb for a couple of months.
Right.
And he will have to work harder. Not that he, you know, he can't, but he'll have to work harder to draw attention and inflect the process in a public way. But I thought, you know, you saw a pretty confident Greg Abbott out there, you know, now since then he's gone to Washington, he's bargaining with Trump and congressional leaders. He's you know, in the game right now.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think it's, you know, it's interesting to see. So with that, a lot of this we will return to. Thanks to Josh for being here. Thanks to our excellent audio production team in the Dev Studio, the College of Liberal Arts here at UT Austin for helping us out week in and week out, and today helping us with those sound clips. As always, you can find the polling results we discussed and much more at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. And if you haven't been to the website in a while, I would urge you to drop by. We did a refresh, kind of gussied up and remodeled the place a little bit. And a lot of the things that you might be interested in if you listen to this podcast, I think are now easier to find and get to on the, from the front page of the website. A lot more to just bring in at first visit. Stickier, we hope. So have a look at that at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. And of course, thank you for listening, and we'll be back again soon with another Second Reading podcast. The Second Reading podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.